Okay, this is the this is the last lecture in the course, and the time has come to kind of just sit back and take a look at what we've covered in the course of the quarter as a whole, and to try and think through what it all means. This is basically something that I can't do for you. Every one of you in this class, you have to try and do that for yourself. Right? What I've tried to do is give you some of the tools that you need for making up your own mind about these issues. But what you should do now is to just sit back and think about how your own thinking has changed in the course of the quarter. Your own thinking about these core issues that define the whole field of international relations. Above all, this central question of war and peace, what makes for war, other side of that same coin, what makes for a stable international system, related to that are all these normative questions about foreign policy. Is there anything of a general nature that you could say about what makes for good foreign policy? Are there any general principles that should guide how foreign policy should be conducted? All right. You get at those issues not by just absorbing a lot of facts in the hope that if you learn as much about the historical record as you possibly can, that the answers to those fundamental questions will just emerge automatically. You have to do some real thinking. And that means you have to bring a certain theoretical framework to bear in order to draw meaning from the historical record. You know, the theory is important not because it provides you with ready-made answers or because it provides you with some sort of conceptual framework in which all the factual material can be squeezed. It's important because it brings the questions into focus so that when you then approach the historical material, you could see what light it throws on those fundamental conceptual problems. Those it helps you answer those questions. You know what it's like? It's like in biology when you kind of put a chemical stain on a biological specimen, and it throws into relief what's important in what you're observing. It's the same sort of thing. Theory brings out what's important in the historical record. All right? So there's a method for doing this. And a lot of what you've been asked to do in this course is to develop a sense for what that method is and to apply it to the material that we've covered in this course yourself. As you go about doing this kind of thinking, you need a certain framework for drawing your conclusions. And what I suggest you do is just go back to the syllabus. And in the first part of the syllabus, I just laid out some of the questions, the fundamental questions that we're going to, you know, that we were going to be concerned with in this course. You know, can you have war even if no one wants it? Well, how would you answer that question today? And how has your thinking about that issue changed from what it had been before you set foot in this room 10 weeks ago? Is war always the result of aggression, or can people slip into an armed conflict more or less by accident? What effect do nuclear weapons have on international politics? Are they a source of stability, or did the emergence of a stable peace during the Cold War period have relatively little to do with nuclear weapons? And what is the story we're exploring tell us about the effect of different political systems? Do democracies, for example, pursue a particular kind of policy? And if so, is that policy a source of peace or of instability? Right? You know, those are very fundamental issues. And by this point, in having done all this work this quarter, you should be able to talk intelligently about all those questions. In any case, the measure of what you will have gotten out of this class is the degree to which your own thinking about those issues has become more sophisticated than it had been before you started grappling with them at the beginning of the quarter. Okay? So I can't tell you what answers you yourself should give, what your thinking should be. All I could do today is tell you about how my own thinking has changed after, dare I say it, over half a century of being obsessed with all these questions, ever since I was a freshman at Berkeley in 1962. I remember taking an undergraduate course with Raymond Sontag, the author of that Broken World book that you read earlier in the course, and just being bowled over, just being totally overwhelmed by the whole perspective that underlay the lectures that he gave in that course. Because, you know, the power of it derived from the fact that it was totally different from what I had been led to believe. So, you know, if someone had asked me at that time, how do you explain, international conflict, I would have thought, well, you know, it has to be explained in moral terms. If you want to understand what caused the war, you had to figure out who's to blame, you know, who the aggressor was. You know, war is the product of aggression. You know, well, you look at the Second World War, who could be more aggressive than Hitler? You know, look at the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, an act of aggression, pure and simple, bolt from the blue, Cold War, these terrible communists, look how awful Stalin was and how many people he killed internally in Russia and so on. You know, all those sorts of things. Unthinkingly, I said, well, you know, that's the answer. You know, these great international conflicts culminating in these major wars have to be understood in moral terms. You know, who the aggressor was. Aggressor theory of war. And it's like, over the years, come to see the limitations in that point, you know, in that perspective. It's not that there is no such thing as aggression, but the reality is that international politics doesn't work in such a simple, straightforward way. Okay, why was that theory, that war is the product of aggression? Why was it so important? Because it had major implications about policy. If war is the result of aggression, if you want to prevent war, you have to deal with possible aggression for adopting a policy of deterrence. You had to affect the calculations of the would-be aggressor as he faced his moment of truth by making it clear to him that the cost would outweigh any possible benefits. Right? So the whole strategy of deterrence was rooted in a certain theory of what made for war. Okay, that was the view I had when I came in. Yeah, deterrence made sense. You know, that whole theory of war made sense. And over the course of the years, you know, even at the very beginning, I came to say that no, that doesn't capture, and it doesn't come close to capturing what makes for war, or answering the fundamental question of war and peace. My view today is very different. is that war is to be understood as the climax of a political process, you know, unfolding over time, over the space at least of years, maybe over decades, a political process with a certain logic to it. It's not just random events, but there's a logic that leads from one episode to the next episode to the next episode. A logic that has a lot to do with power considerations, with security considerations, strategic considerations. With regard to that process, moral judgments are often very problematic. It's very hard to figure out who's right and who's wrong, who the aggressor is, who the victim is. Moral issues are much grayer than we've been led to believe. Let me talk about that a little bit. What do we mean? A political process. Political as opposed to what? Well, political as opposed to moral, for example. The term political implies it's very hard to make hard and fast moral judgments. You can see things through the eyes of both sides in a conflict. It's hard to say who's right and who's wrong. You know, you think 1914, who's right and who's wrong? You know, were the Austrians wrong in trying to deal with this whole problem of, that Serbia posed, the threat to the integrity, the political integrity of the Austrian Empire coming from Serbia? Or were the Serbs wrong to strive for self-determination, for creating a larger Yugoslav state? You know, it's like very hard to, you know, make these moral judgments. You can make that same point over and over again. This is what we talked about in the post-World War I period when we looked at French policy, German policy. You can understand why the Germans would want to resist the Versailles Treaty. On the other hand, you can understand why the French would be a little bit reluctant to allow Germany to once again reemerge as the number one power in Europe, stronger, in fact, than she had been in 1914. Who's right? Who's wrong? Very hard to make those judgments. A political process, political as opposed to moral in that sense, but also political in the sense that power considerations loom large, political in the sense, political as opposed to military, in the strict sense of the term. People often took the view that military considerations were of fundamental importance, hence the great emphasis on deterrence, which was understood in military terms. Or for that matter, the great importance attached to arms control, which had to do with affecting the workings of the military sphere, the structure of military power, as opposed to reaching understandings on political issues. There's a totally different way of looking at the policy issue. If the notion that military factors are predominant suggests to the right that deterrence is the end-all and be-all of strategy, then the stronger you are, the better. The more powerful your deterrent forces are, the more you'll be able to prevent war. Military buildups are always good. And the left takes the opposite view. Their view is that the workings of the military system can play a fundamental role in bringing on a war that nobody wants. Their claim is, well, you saw this happen once before in July 1914. We don't want it to happen again in the nuclear age. Nuclear age, obviously no one wants a general nuclear war, but the sense is it could happen anyway, more or less by accident. The problem of inadvertent war is taken very seriously, and a war could come that no one wants because of the workings of the military system that's in place at the time. Okay? These are military concepts of what makes for war. Say, well, There's a different view. This is the view that war is the outcome of a political process. So instead of focusing either on deterrence or on arms control, the central goal of policy should be to manipulate the way in which that military process runs its course. You know, not just affecting the calculations of the parties as they face their moment of truth when a crisis comes to a head, but affecting the whole process that could lead to a crisis in the first place. You know, carrots and sticks. The aim of policy should be to affect the way that process runs its course, affect the calculations of the other parties involved in it by providing them with both incentives to behave in a way that's consistent with your own interests and disincentives in the event that they offer policies that you find objectionable, right? So you want to kind of control a process unfolding over the space of many, many years rather than waiting until it's too late, right? How did I come to develop that way of looking at things, which was at variance with what I had absorbed from the general culture? As a matter of fact, the whole power of these alternate conceptions derives from the fact that they conflict with the conventional wisdom. How did I come to look at it? By approaching the whole issue at abstract level and trying to think these things through on a purely abstract level on the basis of first principles? No, not at all. Quite the contrary, in fact. Basically, the method there was, I didn't even realize it was a method at the time, but the whole process involved reacting to the claims that other people made. People said such and such. Well, you want to look at the historical evidence with an eye to seeing whether those claims are in fact borne out, whether they're in fact accurate. And in fact, that's what we did a lot in this course, wasn't it? We began with 1914. What was the whole lecture in 1914 about? It was about a theory. The inadvertent war theory, a theory which had tremendous importance in terms of its implications about the nuclear age. This is a theory that the military system played the fundamental role in bringing on the war. And we took that theory and we looked at the way it was fleshed out in the scholarly literature, and it turns out that there's no basis for that theory. That this whole notion, the rigidity of the war plans were a fundamental cause of the war. And look how the Kaiser, you know, when he was told that the British might stay out of the war if Germany didn't move against France, he tried to change the war plans and he was told, you know, it can't be done. We're stuck with these plans. We have to go through with the attack even though it no longer makes any political sense. Right? That's a standard view. You still find it in the literature. And then you look at the evidence, it turns out there's no basis for it whatsoever. It turns out that the real story is exactly the reverse of the way it's presented in the literature. Yeah, the General von Moltke, the chief of the general staff, told the emperor, you can't just change the plans like that. And the emperor says, well, basically, you know, hell with you, I'm going to do it anyway. And he turns to a lower-ranking military officer and says, tell the armies to stop the invasion. And the order was complied with. And General von Moltke says, I went home and shed tears of despair. I thought my heart would break. Well, what could be clearer evidence than that story, which plays a key role in supporting this argument about the rigidity of war plans, an argument that plays a fundamental role in this claim that the First World War was an inadvertent war and that therefore, more generally, major conflicts could happen even though no one wants them. Well, you know, all these things have enormous implications, right? The whole business of the mobilization system with everyone wanting to get the first strike and no one wanting to be a slow second, how this led to a war, the different mobilization plans kind of stimulated each other into a frenzy until no one knew how to stop the war, right? Overwhelmed the political process. Turns out, no, it's not true at all. The Germans, the most militaristic country in Europe, their whole strategy was not to move first, was to wait until Russia moved first. They needed that strategy for both domestic political purposes and the whole also of influencing British policy. Right? So you see that even on that level, the level of, you know, basic factual information, the historical evidence doesn't support these claims that are made. So you react to what other people say, and the implications can be quite far-reaching in terms of shaping your own understanding of how things work. All right? And we did that over and over again in this class, right? The whole thing about American intervention in the First World War, the analysis of the Wilson policy, the whole Kennan article reacting to the claims that Kennan made, that it's Wilson's failure to understand how policy should be conducted, his failure to pursue a realist policy, his moralism, his idealism, you know, all of those things, they messed everything up with the implication that policy should be pursued in a totally different way. Right? It's Kennan, right? You react to that in light of what we saw. It's, you know, you react to these general notions that an idealistic policy, a policy not, you know, based on, you know, geopolitical considerations and this amoral, you know, balance of power sort of thinking, that this is the way to go. We saw how the moralism of Wilson led him to pursue a punitive strategy after America came into the war, how the strategy changed practically overnight from peace without victory in January of 1917, to we must crush the Germans by the end of the year. Yeah, it's like, that's an important point. It helps you make up your mind about whether a policy based on moral principles is the way to go. When you see these kind of dangers of pursuing that sort of policy. What else? Then, as I said, we looked at the Treaty of Versailles in the post-1919 period. You could see things through the eyes of both the French and the Germans. You could see that there was a structural problem here, a problem having to do with the structure of power in Europe in the aftermath of the American withdrawal. It helped us get a handle on this question of does the fact that a country has a democratic political system mean it's less likely to go to war? The really interesting stuff there, a lot of it had to do with the Stresemann policy in the late 1920s. Germany, Weimar Germany was a democracy. France was a democracy, and yet you still had this security problem. And you still had this whole problem of German power. And even in the 1920s, before the Depression, well before Hitler, while Germany seemed to be a functioning democracy, people had the sense of, no, a stable international order hadn't taken root. That's why the French decided 1929, before the Depression, to build the Maginot Line. You know, the chronology is very significant in that regard. It has a certain bearing on this old general theory that people have of, as long as countries are democratic, you know, really don't have to worry about them going to war against each other. You know, it's only when the democratic order is overthrown that you have real problems. Right? And then we looked at the 1930s, and one of the most striking things there was that this war that broke out in September of 1939, this was not a war that Hitler wanted at that time. You know, the Germans weren't prepared for it. The Germans thought that they could basically deter British intervention on the part of to help save Poland. That's why the Germans assigned the Nazi-Soviet Pact, to deter the British. Didn't work. It had the opposite effect. We looked at 1941, both the coming of the U.S.-Japanese War and America's entry into the war against Germany. And again, the point there was that all these notions that we had, or that we things that we were led to believe, the ideas that we absorbed from the general culture, they're not borne out by a close study of what happened. You remember the method there, especially about 1941. We brought a certain theory to bear, this realist theory, a theory that countries don't behave suicidally, that they have to take power realities into account. And and that generated these puzzles. The theory didn't provide answers, but it brought the questions into focus. What are the puzzles? Well, here you have Germany. She has her hands full with this war against the Soviet Union. You know, the German invasion of June 1941 hadn't achieved its goals. And you think the last thing that the Germans would want at this point was a war with the United States. The same point about Japan. Here's Japan bogged down in this endless war in China that had begun in 1937. Saying she can't even defeat China. She's going to, you know, take on, just out of sheer war lust, this by far the strongest country in the world in terms of its mobilizable war potential? Doesn't make sense, right? In either case, doesn't make sense. And those are, like I said, those are kind of loose threads in the fabric of the received wisdom. And you start pulling on those loose threads, and the whole fabric begins to unravel. It turns out, Pearl Harbor wasn't a bolt from the blue. It wasn't the case that the United States was a country that asked only to be left alone. We didn't care what was going on in the rest of the world. You know, it was just, you have these kind of, insane, war-crazy, militarist regimes, and they just, they just love having a war. It's just that sort of view simply is not supported by the evidence. American policy was far more active than that. Incidentally, the whole business about the story of Roosevelt's policy in 1941 and America's road to war in 1941, it's of interest for another reason. About a decade ago, in the aftermath of the U.S. war with Iraq, there was this whole big criticism of the Bush policy. I'm sure you remember this because it got a lot of attention at the time. And the whole idea there was, the Bush strategy marked a total break with American tradition. You know, in the past, America had only fought, quote, wars of necessity. That's to say, purely defensive wars. We had only gone to war when we ourselves were attacked. And now this terrible George W. Bush broke with that American tradition by launching this war against Iraq. Instead of just fighting wars of necessity, now America, it seemed, was fighting these wars of choice. And wars of choice are a terrible thing, and so we should go back and only fight wars of necessity. You know, you found that kind of rhetoric around you all the time. You look at the historical record, it's like all of our wars are wars of choice. Right, this war with Nazi Germany, this was not a war that Hitler wanted at that time. It was not as though a German attack on the United States was imminent. Right? Maybe it would be inevitable at some point in the future if Germany were able to defeat Russia. But if that was the view, the decision to put the United States on a collision course with Germany and fight this undeclared war with Germany and so on, which was the background to the whole America's entry into the European War, this has to be understood in preventive war terms. The key document from that period, the victory program of September 11th, get this, September 11th, 1941, 60 years to the date before the attacks on New York and Washington. The victory program was a preventive war document. It basically said, we can't just sit on our hands while Germany defeats Russia and then has a couple of years to bring order out of chaos in the occupied areas, and then Germany would be able to harness the vast resources of Europe, from the Atlantic to the Urals, to Germany's war machine, and Germany would become essentially unconquerable. And there would be no living with Germany in the future. And so, therefore, we couldn't sit on our hands and just wait for that to happen. We had to move faster than that. We had to do whatever was necessary to get into the war. And you have here a political system in the United States that's averse, as at least on the surface, to going into war as an act of policy, and that everything has to be framed in defensive terms. So this creates an enormous incentive for the political leadership to stage manage things in such a way as it would seem on the surface that the United States was the innocent victim of unprovoked attack. Roosevelt puts the United States on collision course with Japan, but it's the Japanese who make the first move. Does that mean that the Japanese attack was a bolt from the blue and had nothing to do with American policy? That's not the way American policymakers viewed it at the time. Now, why is this important? Because it totally, it has a very major bearing on the viability of that aggressor theory of war. Because if you have countries like Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, the two most aggressive great powers in the modern history of great power politics, and even their actions, the actions that culminated in the war with America, are not to be understood in terms of aggression pure and simple. And that American policy in this regard was far more active, and that American policy also is not to be, the Americans aren't to be accused of acting on the basis of pure aggressiveness. You see how on both sides policies are shaped by powerful political considerations. And that is perfectly normal. If it's the case, even in 1941, in the case of these two very aggressive countries, then a fortiori, all the more reason to think that as a general rule, power political considerations loom very large in shaping the course of events. Yeah, important conclusions. And then we came to the Cold War. Once again, it was a question of bringing a certain theory to bear to see why the Cold War was puzzling. Saying, at the time, 1950s, 1960s, I remember people just commonly arguing along these lines. They said, well, the Cold War is an ideological conflict at its core. The Cold War, you saw this communist dictatorship clashing with liberal democracy or a coalition of liberal democracies. Such a clash was natural given the fundamental difference of political ideology. Right? Now the realist theory says not so simple. Doesn't matter what sort of internal regime a country has. What really matters is the structure of the international political system, the distribution of power in the international political system. The external environment, the external power political environment, plays a very fundamental role in shaping policy and can lead even the most ideological countries to trim their sails, to draw in their horns rather than face a war that's essentially unwinnable or winnable only at enormous cost. Right? And we took that view and we applied it to the Cold War period. The Cold War is puzzling. Yeah, of course. The Americans would have loved to see democratic regimes spread throughout all of Europe. And the Soviets, for their part, probably would have loved to see communist regimes come to power throughout the whole of Europe. Right. But neither side was going to push those preferences to the point where there was a serious risk of World War III. The status quo of a divided Europe, with Soviet domination of the part of Europe east of the line of demarcation in Europe, and American domination of the part of Europe west of that line, that status quo of a divided Europe, divided Germany, that was vastly preferable to a Third World War for both America and Russia. And if that was the case, weren't both sides pretty much locked into the status quo, had to respect the status quo? And if they were both locked into the status quo, where was there a problem? Where was the problem coming from? You see, what's going on there is a theoretical perspective, a conceptual perspective, is being brought to bear. You wouldn't see that the Cold War was puzzling unless you brought that perspective to bear. And you use that theoretical framework. It's kind of like a searchlight that you shine on the historical evidence that enables you to see things that you probably would not have otherwise seen. Given those fundamental power realities, didn't the political leaders on both sides understand what the situation was? Weren't they therefore willing to reach some sort of accommodation based on mutual respect for the status quo? And that's the question that draws out the meaning of what happened at Potsdam in 1945, July and August of 1945. And in the whole latter half of 1945, culminating in the Moscow Conference of December of 1945. Both sides move toward an understanding based on mutual acceptance of those kind of core political realities, mutual acceptance of the status quo. Well, this simply, underscores how puzzling the situation is. Because if they were moving in that direction, how do you explain the Cold War breaking out the next year? Well, the Cold War in the sense of the two sides at each other's throats verbally, each kind of, throwing accusations against the other and so on. All right? The answer there was that the Cold War is not to be understood in terms of this kind of very general ideological conflict, but rather specific concerns. And in particular, this problem about West Germany. Because if there's this general rule about how the two sides can live with each other in the post-1945 period, this general rule is each side calls the shots in its part of Europe. For there to be a problem, there has to be some exception to that general rule. And what is that exception? The Soviets cannot give the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they want in West Germany. Because a very strong West Germany would necessarily pose a threat to Soviet control in the part of Germany they occupy. And if the situation is such that the Western powers are led to underwrite a revisionist German policy of that sort in order to keep West Germany in the Western camp, well, that would pose real problems for the Soviets. So that problem of West German power necessarily lies at the heart of the Cold War. But why does it suddenly come into being in 1946? Answer there is it had a lot to do with the Soviets pressing toward their south, thinking that there was a power vacuum that would allow Soviet power to penetrate into the countries on their southern periphery, Turkey and Iran. And then that led to a shift in American policy, the realization that the European settlement could not be made on a relatively friendly basis, that you're dealing with people who only respect force, only respect military power. Therefore, you have to generate military power by mobilizing the feelings of your own people, by over-defining the threat. Again, this relates to this whole issue of do democracies conduct better foreign policies than other sorts of regimes. Plus, you had to kind of point the finger at the Soviets as the great saboteurs of German unity in order to get the Germans to accept the sort of system that you want to create, a system which is based on the notion that Germany will remain divided. Right? So the Turkish and Iranian business in 1946 is the trigger that sets a kind of security dilemma dynamic in motion, a spiral dynamic. You know, where we need to create power as a counterweight to the Soviets, so we move ahead on the German question, you know, basically toward economic, ultimately political, military reconstruction of Germany. The Soviets understand this is threatening. They move to kind of counter this. That in turn is viewed by us as even more threatening, so it raises the ante and so on. So you have a spiral dynamic there. And the whole security dilemma theory, the spiral model that's connected with it, as I told you, a theory that was developed in this very building, it really does help you understand what the Cold War was about. Not aggressors, pure and simple. Not like, look how awful the Soviets are, you know, with their communist ideology that pushes them toward acting aggressively. Or for that matter, the argument that the left made during the period of the Vietnam War, that it's the Americans who are the aggressive ones, and the Americans who are propelled by their need to find markets for their surplus production and so on, you know, pursue policies that led to the Cold War. Neither of those views is correct, nor even necessary to explain why you have the Cold War. A security dilemma dynamic. The idea that countries are led to pursue offensive policies for purely defensive reasons, and that you could have a conflict even between countries that would be happy to accept the status quo if they had some sort of guarantee that everyone else was willing to do so. This could lie at the heart of international political life. All right. That's what the Cold War is about. Why did it continue? A system came into being, you'd think, that met everyone's needs. That the Soviet number one concern in Europe, the control of German power. Well, you have this set of arrangements that's negotiated at Paris in October of 1954, the Paris Accords. Paris Accords, you know, as I said, they satisfy the basic Soviet need in Europe for the control of German power by embedding Germany in its larger structure, its NATO structure, dominated by the United States, limiting German power both politically and militarily. The Germans can't have nuclear weapons according to this system, and if they don't have nuclear weapons, they're dependent on nuclear powers like the United States for protection. They can't stand up to the Soviets on their own. Shouldn't that have led to a relatively stable peace? Well, in principle, yes, it should have. Soviets would accept it. Germans would, for a different set of reasons, were also prepared to accept it. The problem was that the Americans weren't willing to accept it. This is the whole, the core of the Eisenhower strategy. Eisenhower didn't want America to be, you know, a great imperial power, basing, you know, vast armies all around the world and so on. Basically, the Europeans, meaning the West Europeans, the continental West Europeans, West Germany, France, and the other smaller countries around them, they had the resources, if they could only come together, to balance Soviet power on their own without direct American support. Europe should become a third great power mass in world affairs, Eisenhower says. When that happened, we can then sit back and relax somewhat. We could withdraw from Europe. Right? One, very much to move in that direction. The problem is that such a solution is not inherently stable because it implied a strong Germany. And once Germany became strong, what was to lock Germany into defensive policy? Soviets would be led to move before that happened. And then you'd have to deal with the Soviet problem. Right? It should have been clear, if people could analyze these things in a more penetrating way, that there was no purely European solution to the European security problem. That the whole Eisenhower policy, though very admirable on a certain level, you know, it's like, we want the Europeans to carry the burden of their own defense. We don't want them to be simply an American fiefdom, an American dependency. You know, that's admirable. But the political consequences of it were quite severe. Because the more you moved in that direction, toward arming the West Germans with nuclear weapons, nuclear sharing policy, the more the Soviets were bound to become concerned. That's the taproot of the Berlin business. The Berlin crisis is not to be understood in terms of Soviet aggressiveness, pure and simple. It's to be understood in terms of these basic structural problems that had to do with the particular choices that the Eisenhower administration made. Right? And that's why the coming to power of John F. Kennedy in January 1961 is so important. Dramatic change in American policy. Not at the military level. A lot of what you've heard about massive retaliation being replaced by flexible response is a gross distortion of what was actually going on in the military sphere. The fundamental change was political. It had to do with this whole notion of, should the United States try and withdraw from Europe, try and arm the Europeans so that they could defend themselves without direct American support, meaning helping them acquire nuclear capabilities, or should we realize that a true United States of Europe is just pie in the sky, that maybe it's not such a great idea for Germany to have nuclear weapons, and that therefore there's no alternative than a continuing American military presence in Europe, because if the Germans can't defend themselves, someone's going to have to do it. There has to be a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. Only the Americans could provide it. We are stuck in Europe. It's not like we want to be a great imperial power over there. There's no alternative for us. That's the basic Kennedy conception. Right? And you'd say, well, you know, he lays this out to Khrushchev when they meet at Vienna in June of 61. Soviets, they don't want to go for it. Because they see these changes in American policy as reflecting U.S. weakness, America's unwillingness to face the prospect of a nuclear war. And because the Americans are so scared of that, you know, a tough Soviet line, you know, shaking the tree, they'll be able to get more and more concessions. So the more we move in the direction of trying to work out a peaceful settlement with the Soviets, the more the Soviets take this as a sign of weakness, the more intransigent they become. And all this stuff builds up to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is not an isolated event. It's to be understood very much in the context of this big crisis that's developing in Europe, central crisis in U.S.-Soviet relations. Right? Kennedy, why does he decide to accept the Cuban Missile Crisis? Again, this is the whole Windows argument. He accepts it because he knows that the American nuclear edge will soon be gone. And that if a showdown with the Soviets is inevitable, let's have it out with them while we're still relatively strong. That's clearly in his mind when he decides to accept the challenge over Cuba and make it into a very central test of strength in relations with the Soviets. Right? Important point. Because people think of the Cuban Missile Crisis, isolated event. Turns out it's to be understood in this general context. And the crisis plays an important role in the subsequent story, because after it, the whole bankruptcy of the Khrushchev policy is revealed. And the rudiments of a relatively stable international order fall into place. Not 100% stability. There are still some basic problems. There's this fundamental structural problem of the defense of Western Europe in an era of nuclear parity. Right? That could have been a very major problem. It never reached that point, in large part because of internal changes that were taking place in the Soviet Union itself, the decline of the whole communist system during the Brezhnev period, and so on. You could say, well, we lucked out. Cold War is over. Okay. Well, and now we're living in this world where people don't take the prospect of a new general war at all seriously. There's a sense, people call it the end of history, is a famous book about this. People think, oh, all this stuff, it's all over. We've left the white water, and we've entered into the blue seas of perpetual peace. there's not really a hell of a lot to be learned from an analysis of the international politics during the 20th century. I don't think that that's the case. International politics never stops. And the basic conceptual framework that you work out for yourself by thinking about these problems in the past, thinking about them in the light of certain theoretical perspectives, that framework continues to be applicable as the basis for our thinking about current issues like this whole current Ukraine business. All right? That, at any rate, is what I personally have taken away from thinking about these issues over the last 50 years. And I should say, I don't expect you to kind of buy all this stuff wholesale, but that's the kind of thing that I hope you've gotten out of the course. So on that note, let me just thank you for all the effort that you put into the course this quarter and wish you good luck on the exam on Friday and also the paper next week. Thank you. Oh.